Hi, podcast listeners. This is Tony Beam of Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. We're excited about today's program. Don't miss it, because we're going to be talking about the real timeline from Uvalde, Texas, which is now just beginning to emerge. We're also going to discuss common sense approaches to school security. We've got a great interview with South Carolina Senator Josh Kimbrell, and we'll remember Memorial Day and the veterans who made our freedoms possible. I hope you'll join us for the show. All right. Good morning, everybody. Thanks for joining us for Christian Worldview with Tony and Austin. This is Tony Beam. I'm the Director of Church and Community Engagement for the Tim Brazier Campus of North Greenville University, where Christ makes the difference. My co-host is Austin Barker. He is en route. He'll be here shortly. All right. We need to go back, and as the police officer that gave the report yesterday said three times, clean up or clarify some of the details of what happened in the shooting. This is coming from the Washington Post this morning. It could come from anywhere. It's posted in a lot of different places, but this was just a pretty straightforward account, so I thought it would be a good place to start. A gunman roamed around outside a Texas elementary school for about 12 minutes, entered without challenge, and spent an hour inside before he was killed by law enforcement, authorities said Thursday, revising key details in their account of the massacre as the police response to it was criticized by some parents. Now, that's it. The reason you see why I would pick this. That's just a very straightforward paragraph. It tells you everything. It's going to expound a little bit, but everything you need to know is right there. This kid arrived. He 12 minutes outside. He was not confronted by anybody. It was that first they said he was confronted by a police officer and they exchanged fire. The police officer was wounded. Then he was confronted by a police officer. They exchanged fire. Then he was confronted by a police officer, and the police officer didn't exchange fire with him, but did confront him. None of that's true. He didn't encounter anybody. He walked around 12 minutes outside and found an unlocked door and went inside the building. The police arrived within 4 minutes. We're going to get to that part. The new details on how 18-year-old Salvador Ramos was able to kill 19 children and two teachers at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas, on Tuesday, together with cell phone videos and witness accounts of police outside tackling or handcuffing desperate parents who tried to rush into the building, called into question earlier claims by Governor Greg Abbott that a quick response by law enforcement had saved lives. Now, this is the Washington Post, so they're going to immediately attack a Republican governor. This is not just what Governor Greg Abbott said about it. This is what he was told by law enforcement officials, and this is what every news outlet was reporting for the first 24 hours. So this is when you read the news, learn how to do it in a way that tells you how much of this is politically motivated without seeming to be political. Mentioning Greg Abbott as the one is putting a Republican governor on the hot seat when they could have sourced police sources, they could have sourced anybody, but Republican governor Greg Abbott. Police who arrived at the school retreated when Ramos shot at them, state authorities said on Thursday. An hour elapsed before a tactical unit led by Federal Border Patrol agents went into a classroom and killed the gunman. Here's another part of the story that wasn't true. I mean, we sort of had this picture painted to us of a wandering Border Patrol agent who just happened to come up on the scene. They call these guys. These guys came in. It was a team of Border Patrol, of a border tack, which they were, you know, specially trained for this kind of thing. And they showed up, went into the building, and took out the shooter. But it wasn't, you know, we heard it was this one border tech agent who went in. I mean, one account I read, he went in by himself. And another account I read, he went in with local law enforcement backing him up. We're getting down to the skinny, which is this is a unit that showed up and went into the building and confronted and took out the shooter. But it had been an hour. The new details of how 18-year-old Salvador Ramos was able to kill, police who arrived An hour lapsed before a tactical unit led by Federal Border Patrol agents went into the classroom and killed the gunman. The initial response appears to have veered from guidance widely implemented since the 1999 massacre at Columbine High School in Colorado that says officers should pursue shooters inside buildings without waiting for specialized backup. That's what just about every law enforcement agency, that's their policy.
And I thought after Parkland, that especially,
right.
That we decided that's not the way to handle it. You got to go in.
Right. Texas authorities on Thursday also retracted a previous claim that an officer had approached and possibly fired at the gunman outside the school, saying that, in fact, the shooter walked in and disrupted. About 10 minutes before Ramos went into the building, authorities said he opened fire on witnesses by a nearby funeral home, and a 9/11 caller reported a man carrying a gun. The amended account of the shootings was offered by Victor Escalon Jr., regional director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, who said three times that he would clear up previous statements. Escalon spoke at a chaotic news conference Thursday afternoon after the appearance in news reports and on social media of the cell phone videos, some of which showed tearful parents pleading with officers in tactical gear, some carrying rifles or tasers, to go inside the school and tackle the gunman or allow them to do so themselves. Then you had Javier Cazares, whose 9-year-old daughter Jackie was inside the school, said in an interview that he and another man demanded action from the police as they huddled by a door to the school. There were five or six of us fathers hearing the gunshots, and police officers were telling us to move back. We didn't care about us. We wanted to storm the building. You know, that's heart-rending. That's hard. That's hard stuff to read. I do not understand. I can't imagine a world where you've got police officers huddled outside a building where they can hear gunshots. They're armed. They have some level of training. Now, I do have a story here because they interviewed one of the people who was involved. Let's see if I can find it right quick. Yeah, here it is. This is coming from Daily Wire. Texas DPS Lieutenant Chris Olivares said that law enforcement officers had not entered Robb Elementary School right away because they were concerned that they could be shot.
Well, I heard that two were wounded initially. When they first came in, they encountered
fire,
and one or two were wounded, and then they backed out.
Yeah, but I don't know that that's true.
Because that's what this guy said.
The story, what I'm reading from the Washington Post,
right,
is it doesn't include that. Now, Olivares spoke with CNN anchor Wolf Blitzer on Thursday's broadcast of the Situation Room. Blitzer asked why officers had waited outside rather than rushing the school and engaging the active shooter at the first possible moment. Olivares began by explaining that officers had gone into the school very quickly, but they heard the gunfire and call for backup. Opting to wait for the assistance of a tactical team that could provide rather than rather than charging into the classroom where the shooter had already barricaded himself. I don't know. These people need to lose their jobs. There is no world in which you have police officers with weapons. They get inside. They're The guy's shot at, he shoots at them, and they retreat outside. They can hear him shooting his weapons inside the building, and they don't go in and try to take this guy out. You know, risking their life is part of what being a police officer is about. Olivares agreed, but then he went on to explain why the officers at the scene had chosen to take a different approach. The active shooter situation, you want to stop the killing. You want to preserve life. But also one thing that, of course, the American people need to understand, that officers are making entry into this building. They do not know where the gunman is. They're hearing shots. They're receiving gunshots at that point. If they proceed any further, not knowing where the suspect was at, they could have been shot. They could have been killed. and that gunman would have had an opportunity to kill other people inside the school. Well, here's a news flash for you. He had all the opportunity he needed for 60 minutes to kill as many people as he wanted to because nobody went in to get shot. Yes, it's true. If the police had gone in and he had killed everybody that came through the door, it wouldn't have solved the problem. But solving the problem also doesn't rest in the fact that they stand around outside and he's unimpeded. You know, one thing, at least if the police were attacking his barricaded position, he would have to be shooting at them and not just killing children that are sitting there waiting to see who's next. Okay, we're going through this Washington Post story because this is the latest information about the timeline. And I think it's important that we know something about that. Escalon, who was leading the press conference yesterday, defended the police response at Thursday's news conference, beginning with an emotional remark about how the toll that it had taken on law enforcement. It's hard to take. It's traumatic. We're all hurting inside, he said. I don't doubt that. I mean, people are hurting inside that don't know anything about these people, that don't live in that community, including me. But after 2 days in which officials had offered partial and contradictory details of how the shooting unfolded, Escalon's account also was confusing and unclear at points. He said the gunman, who shot his grandmother and fled in a pickup truck, crashed the vehicle at 11:28 a.m. Photographs from the scene show the gray Ford pickup stopped next to broken railings at a ditch-like concrete area beside the western perimeter of the school grounds. At 11:30, police received the first 911 call reporting that a man who had crashed a vehicle was carrying a gun. Escalon said witnesses described the gunman exiting the passenger side of his truck, carrying a rifle and a bag. He opened fire on two people who had walked out of a funeral home across the street, according to Escalon's telling of the witness accounts. The gunman then walked toward the school, climbed a fence, and shot at the school from a parking lot. He appears to have entered the school through a door that was unlocked. Texas State Trooper Juan Maldonado, who lives in Uvalde, said he and others entered the school building where the shooting took place and broke windows to rescue children from classrooms. We went in the building, we broke windows, we got kids out, Maldonado said. He declined to say who was with him or when precisely this took place. He said one of the teachers killed was like his sister. Officials had previously stated that the gunman was confronted by a school officer who fired at him. Later, they said the officer had confronted him but did not open fire. Escalon said Thursday that both versions were inaccurate. No officer confronted the gunman before he entered the west side of the school at 11:40, Escalon said, adding there was not an officer readily available. A Uvalde School District security plan says the fencing around Robb was designed to limit and or restrict access to individuals without a need to be on campus and that the district operates a locked classroom door policy at all times. Officers from the Uvalde Police Department and the School District Police Department arrived 4 minutes after the gunman entered the school, according to Escalon, who offered unclear statements about how close those officers got to Ramos. Having first said the officers were inside making entry and took cover after coming under fire, he then said they didn't make entry initially because of the gunfire. So there you go. They're finally getting some of the facts straight. And the reason they're doing it is because of cell phone video and parents who were out there and witnessed all this. One woman was put in handcuffs, and because she knew some of the Uvalde police officers, convinced the state police to take the handcuffs off of her. And as soon as they did, she jumped a fence. She sort of snuck away from them, jumped a fence, went in and got her two daughters and let them out. You had another parent that they have a video of this parent who was trying to get into the building, a male, and he was tackled by police. Which, look, I understand. If you're an unarmed, untrained citizen and you're trying to rush into a building where somebody's heavily armed and obviously demonstrated they intend to kill people, the police are trying to protect those people's lives.
Don't you say, sir, get back, I'm going in.
Well,
I mean, isn't that what you say?
That's what you say. Right. Well, they did tell him. They told him two or three times, you can't enter the building to get back. But see,
what's missing? Because we are entering the building.
He was telling, and that's what he was telling them. He was telling them, get in there.
I don't know if this is true. I guess I'm not as angry as I will be if I find out this is true.
Well, this is now the official version. This happened. There's cell phone video of it. There were six men who were going to rush the shooter without weapons, and they stopped them from going in the building because while these police officers were standing around there, out there, fully armed, and some of them had tactical gear.
Alston, how long do you think the shooter was in the school?
It was close to an hour.
Yes.
Yeah, it was an hour.
Yep. And Most of the shooting took place early on as he entered, but it still happened.
Right.
During that hour.
What we found out too yesterday is, you know, this story about the Border Patrol, the border tech guy that showed up and went in, and that was a team that arrived on the scene. Evidently they'd been called, and they got there and they went in and took the guy out pretty quick. But and one of them was wounded in the process. But the idea that there's no question that police officers stood outside that building and didn't go in. I mean, if they entered and received fire and then retreated, is what it appears.
Every single one of those police officers that engaged in that, and I don't know how to distinguish between the ones that didn't and the ones that had good reason and the one that didn't. Every single one of them needs to be fired at least. And probably, if I were them, I would resign from the human race.
I know. That's exactly. I can't fathom, because
how can you live with yourself?
That's what I want to know. How can you, especially if you're armed and have some protection? You know, it's one thing. You've got parents, of course, which I mean, you think that had to shoot me. I'd have been one of the dead, but I'd have been shot by the police if my grandkids are in there. No, I mean,
and you better have a team.
I'd have told them, you know, shoot me or get out of the way, but I'm going in there. You know, I mean, and I know that sounds like, oh, you're just being. No, I'm just telling
when
you.
When the facts on the ground are that clear,
anybody would have done that. I mean, I think anybody. So, I'm with you on this.
How do you have an entire police force? How do you have a whole squad, a battalion out there?
I mean, there was
and
enough.
And no one goes in.
Yeah, well, there wasn't a battalion, but, I mean, we want to be clear. There were enough police officers outside that if they had gone in force, some of them, yes, could have been shot. I mean, I don't know if you heard me reading the police officer who said, you know, they asked him, why didn't they go in? And the answer was, well, they could have been shot. And I mean, how do you say that with a straight face? How do you, as a trained officer, say we couldn't act because our lives would be in danger when somebody's in there shooting children who have no hope? I mean, I just can't put those two things together in my head. So yeah, this is the problem. I mean, there would have been lives lost, but that would have been it would have been much less if they had gone in, because like I said, even if you're going down a hallway, let's say he's barricaded at the end of a hall. I don't know. But if the police officers are drawing his fire, then he's not killing the children. He's shooting at the police. And if the police engage him in active fire, I mean, if they keep firing at this guy, then they've kept him until they can get somebody in there to take him out from just simply walking around and killing people. I don't, and I know you have to be, if he was barricaded in there, you'd have to be worried about firing at him, hitting one of the children. I mean, there are no accounts where, you know, he held up a child and, you know, used him as a shield or anything like that. None of that is anywhere in this. So, I don't know. I don't have an explanation. I'm angry that, first of all, that this happened. But then the way it happened makes it worse because of the possibility that existed that there could have been a resolution long before he had an hour to stay in there and do whatever he decided to do. So, all right.
I'm so tired, for one, of people with unserious solutions that are not talking about solving this problem. I'm hearing it. I'm reading, and everybody I read, I just walk away and say, you're not really serious about this, are you? You're not serious about solving this problem, because we get into this. What about, well, with children dying from abortion, 60 million. Fine. Yes, true, but totally misplaced emphasis.
Well, I'll tell you.
Stop with the false comparisons and the distraction. Can we please address the issue on its own merits? And now this whole thing with the police's failure, okay? The failure of the police force is going to become the story, rather than addressing what I feel like is root causes.
I don't think that'll become the story.
You don't think so?
I think it's a part of the story, and it needs to be, but I don't think it'll supersede the fact that these children were killed in the classroom. Mm. Now, I will say that I like what Charles Cook did at a national review today, because what people are saying is that children are not safe. That if you get up and send your kids to school this morning, you have to worry that they're not going to be safe in the school. Because Eric Swalwell he hit the floor yesterday, and just talking about it's a lie. He said on MSNBC yesterday, he claimed that it's a lie to tell our children that they're safe at school. But that's not a lie. And this is where statistics do matter. I mean, this idea that great numbers of children are being killed in schools all across the country has got parents in a panic, understandably, but it's not something that they should they need to be hurt and broken over the fact that these children died in Texas. But sending their kids to school, there's going to be a little bit of reservation, but it shouldn't be the kind of panic that Eric Swalwell's talking about, where he says it's a lie to tell children they're not safe in school. And here's what Cook wrote. Government data shows that 54 million American children are in school, public and private, and that somewhere between 3.4 and 4.6 million enter school each year for the first time. So we're growing every year between 3.4 and 4.6. So if you use the 4 million as a rough guide for the latter number, just back of the envelope math says this. It means that over the last 23 years, 146 million children have been enrolled in America's 131,000 schools at some point. So that's 100, and there's been 110 people who have been killed K through 12, and that includes students and teachers. That doesn't indicate 110 out of 146 million doesn't indicate that you can back up a statement that says, don't send your kids to school because they're not safe. That's just not true. Now, does that mean we shouldn't do something about the gun violence? No. Does that have anything to do with whether we should pass laws or come up with a new strategy or address this in some kind of serious way? No. But it is important when people are lying about the state of schools in general, to where everybody's going, well, it's not safe to send my children to school. It's not safe to fly on an airplane. I mean, I hate to fly. Why? Because I don't want to crash and die. I mean, that's why I don't like getting on an airplane. But it's silly for me to say, for example, I'm going to drive to Nashville instead of fly. The chances of me dying on the road between here and Nashville in my truck in an accident are exponentially higher than if I get on an airplane and fly from Greenville to Nashville. Because when there's a plane crash, yeah, everybody on that plane usually dies. But the vast numbers of people that fly every day, flying is the safest mode of travel in the world. And by the same token, when you look at the statistics, they do mean something. And what they mean in this case is that schools are not unsafe. It's wrong to tell children that it's okay for you to go to school today because you'll be safe. In the vast, vast majority of cases, that's the truth. There is a bipartisan effort going on There's a group of Republicans, a group of Democrats that are working, according to the New York Times, to try to come up with something that they can pass. After the deadliest school shooting in a decade, a small group of Republican and Democrat senators have begun an urgent and uphill effort to strike a compromise on new gun laws, voicing hope that a wave of collective outrage at the slaughter of 19 children and two teachers could finally conquer a decade of congressional paralysis. Members of the bipartisan group emerged from a private meeting on Thursday determined to work quickly to try to reach a deal on modest steps to limit access to guns. They agreed to spend the Memorial Day recess examining a number of proposals, including ways to incentivize states to pass so-called red flag laws aimed at taking firearms away from potentially dangerous people and expanding criminal background checks for gun buyers. So, essentially, they're looking at three elements that they're trying to merge together. One is the expanded background check. Two, there is no appetite in Washington to pass a federal red flag law. They're not going to be able to do that. But they could offer incentives to states for the states to pass red flag laws, which, by the way, if we're going to have, and I'm not saying we've got to have red flag laws, but I'm saying if we're going to have them, the more local they are, the better, because I'm much more willing to trust South Carolina's decision-making in coming up with a red flag law than I am for the federal government to force one on us that is not going to take into consideration the things that I think locally, if we put a red flag law together, we would take into consideration. And so I think the trust level, back again, red flag laws are not likely to pass because of the level of trust that we do not have for government to make these decisions. So if the closer you get to the people with a decision like that, the more likely it is you can come up with something that has enough trust to get something passed. Now, that's not saying there's going to be total trust, because I don't think we're going to have total trust in government. I don't know if we'll ever get that back. And probably we shouldn't. I mean, I think you should always approach people that have the power to change your life through the passage of laws with a little bit of skepticism. But I think there should be enough trust that we get something done. And I think the only way that happens with a red flag law is locally, not at the federal level. And that's Senator Graham's. He's the one that's pushing that part of it. So you've got Graham, you've got about 10 or 11 Republican senators that are talking to Chris Murphy, and they're trying to compromise. So one would be expanded universal background checks. Two would be the incentive for red flag laws in various states. And three would be increased security, money for increased security in the schools, which would mean, you know, a variety of things. And I would come back and say the same thing about increased school security as I would about red flag laws. If the federal government wants to provide federal dollars to help states to be able to augment their budgets to provide school security, then okay, maybe that. But I don't think the federal government needs to pass a law necessarily that fits every school district. Because think about the vast number of school districts, the locations. What needs to happen is the schools need to work out a security plan and submit it, and then they need to be funded in order to be able to execute that plan according to that school's needs. I mean, you shouldn't have to have a federal law to tell schools that they have to lock every access door except for one. And then you could even lock that door. You just have somebody sitting there that can release and open the door when it's necessary. You know, I mean, there's a lot of things that could have stopped this. Some of the things that people are talking about won't. Some of the things would. I am a proponent. And if you've been listening, and if you've been listening for as long as I've been doing this show, I'm a proponent of high security at the schools. That's what I think will immediately have the biggest impact.
I'm more open to red flag laws if those red flag laws are locally passed and monitored, and that we have the ability here in South Carolina to sort of decide what that's going to look like. Universal background checks, if they want to do them, fine. I just don't think that's going to do anything. Background check, just lay the template over this situation that we're looking at. Would a background check have stopped this guy? No, would not. He had no criminal record. He had no recorded history of mental illness.
But a red flag law that flagged might his have. Mental health condition,
that's
because
right.
there were flags that were there.
Right.
If we know where to look and if we know
right.
to look.
Right.
And if we have a protocol in place for looking.
And if you can put enough restrictions on people who would be bad actors that would try to use it to hurt somebody.
And will I mean, some people and, get and swept to, up in that net that don't belong there?
Probably.
Is that a price that we can afford to pay? I mean, I don't want to pay the price of confiscation. There
right.
are some prices
right.
to our freedoms that are too high to pay.
Right.
But that one
that's
is a legitimate
good.
Price to pay,
that's
I think.
Good. That's good. That's a good... What is the cost... Because nothing's going to be perfect.
Right.
So what is the cost of a red flag law that's locally worked out and managed as compared to a confiscation plan? Okay. Now we're talking
or
about
ban
light
all
years.
Assault
well,
weapons. Ban, you
and,
know.
And they're not going to do that.
Right.
They're not. It's because you've got to define what that means. And, you know, then what are you going to do? You're going to tell all these people that have them that they have to turn them in? That's not going to happen. I mean, it's not in this country. And don't give me Great Britain, don't give me Belgium, don't give me France. None of those countries have the freedom of access to weapons or the culture of a Second Amendment that protects that access as part of their founding document that we do and have the history of it. I mean, once you get to 500 million guns out there, taking the guns is not an option. You've got to find another way, is all I'm saying. So, Bill, he has something different, he says.
This is a different bill.
Oh, a different bill. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry. Yes, Bill, go ahead.
He might have something different to say, though, too.
I might have something different to say this morning, Tony. How you doing?
I'm good, man. How you doing?
I'm great. I got two issues for you.
Okay.
Number one, why is it a federal issue?
Yeah, that's what
and
we're talking about.
Not a local and state issue.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
So why does the federal government have to get involved in the local politics and the local school protection and all that kind of thing? I think the local people can take care of it, and we don't need the federal government involved in it.
Well, I think
that's what some
of them are saying. I mean, I think that's what Senator Graham is saying when he's saying, if you're going to try to have some kind of red flag law, you're not going to be able to do it from the federal level. That needs to be state by state.
And we can just facilitate it or incentivize
right.
it. Yeah,
or
it's a good question, Bill. I think it's a legitimate
right.
question to ask.
No, it is. Yeah. But I think that's yeah. what they're talking about, which is much better.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, go ahead.
The second issue is I'm totally in favor of having resource officers in the schools for protection, which we do here, I think, most in our area anyway, which is a great thing. And our local tax dollars pays for that, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's correct.
Yeah.
So my question is, I think that in addition to that, that the private schools should get the same protection.
Yeah, I agree. But
they're paying tax dollars. They're paying tax right. dollars just as much.
Right.
And they are deserving of protection just like anyone else.
Right. Well, what you've got in the passage of this educational savings account bill in South Carolina, which is a bare minimum of parental freedom and student freedom in deciding where they're going to go to school, it does include private schools, which means we've now legislatively in South Carolina opened the door for the possibility of state money going to assist private schools. So that's, you know, that you're right. And that's an important step. See, when you've got so many hurdles, when you try to do something legislatively, you have to step over so many things. The argument begins with, well, we don't fund private schools in South Carolina with tax dollars. Well, yeah, actually, now we do. So you don't have to step over that one anymore. So that it's more open to the possibility of universal coverage and security for schools. So anyway, Bill, thanks. I appreciate the call. Those are good points that you made.
Yeah.
Let me preface what I'm about to say by saying that I have great respect for every level of law enforcement. And I believe that we need multiple levels of law enforcement. I don't think every single police officer has to have specialized training in techniques that are advanced in taking out a shooter. Okay, I don't think it's necessary for every police officer to have that. But when we talk about resource officers in our schools, that's not what I'm talking about. I'm not talking about a guy who's a good police officer that has been to the academy, has had good training, and is there in the school building relationships with students, teachers, being a liaison to the community. I'm all for that. Maybe we keep those. But I'm talking about adding, at a minimum, two highly trained tactical officers who they're not building relationships with the students. They're not building relationships with the teachers. You ever watch Secret Service agents when a vice president or a president comes to town?
They're not very polite.
They're not very talkative. They're not real chatty. Mm-hmm. They're not building relationships with the crowd. They're constantly scanning for threats.
They might give you a sharp elbow now and then.
Exactly. And that's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about people that's their focus. You two guys, you've got one job, and that's to make sure that we never have a mass shooting in this school. And so in some schools, like in most schools, elementary schools in particular, two and a resource officer would be enough. I mean, if you want, you don't have to have the resource officer, but actually it'd be kind of nice to have somebody that represents the police as a resource officer who's trained and would probably engage, but they're not the Navy SEALs of law enforcement. They kind of could be a liaison between these two highly trained officers and the school system.
And if you pair that with arming teachers, arming and training teachers.
The ones that are, you got
willing.
Yeah, okay, we're first of all, here's how we're going to do it. If you teach in this school and would like to be trained and licensed to carry a firearm, sign up. And then you run background checks, you put them through the ringer, you find out what their level of comfort is with a weapon. And out of the 20 that sign up, maybe you get 10 or
whatever,
or 10,
a number of them,
that you would say, okay, yeah, well, we would be comfortable with you conceal carrying a firearm. And then you arm them and you put them in. Now, the people that scream about that,
and you don't have all three of them on one hall,
right? You spread
you
them
think,
out,
you think about
throughout
that.
The school.
Yep,
so now you've
now
you've
these
got,
this is what it sounds like when people talk seriously.
It is
okay. This is practical rubber meets the road stuff.
It's very doable. And it makes perfect sense.
And it has a low downside.
Right. It does. Because you're not, you know, the screamers who would say, you know, they want to blame the gun. This is what happens if you buy into this idea that the gun is the problem itself. The gun can be part of the solution. The gun can make it possible for people, the bad guys with the gun, to be neutralized before they kill people. And that if we would just that's what needs to be embraced. Now, I'm moving in the direction of a red flag law if it's local. I mean, I think you need to be able if you have a red flag law, then there has to be a legal challenge. In other words, if somebody says you shouldn't have a gun, then in a court rules that they're right, you shouldn't have a gun, you should be able to appeal and have another group look at that before you lose the ability to have a firearm.
A well-drafted, this is David French, and he said it right at the beginning, and I still like it. A well-drafted red flag law should contain abundant procedural safeguards. That's
right.
What you're describing.
That's what I'm saying.
Including imposing a burden of proof on the petitioner, hearing requirements, and a default expiration date. I like that because that puts a stiff arm to the downside of a red flag law. It recognizes the potential for abuse.
I think the last statement there, that it has an expiration date.
A default expiration date.
Is really important because when you get to that expiration date, then you examine again. You say, okay, has the situation changed?
It has an automatic revisitation protocol.
Exactly.
Yes.
And then you could get
It's not indefinite.
And it's regularly scheduled.
Yes.
So that you're not just sitting there. It's almost like parole.
That's what serious solutions sound like, is they have specificity, they have recognition of downsides. That's what it sounds like.
Right. And I get it. My whole reservation has always been lack of trust, but there are people.
And that accounts for it. That kind of puts the government, and it kind of gets a hand on the rein and says, I'm not giving you your head on this.
It doesn't make me 100% trust.
Me either.
But it gets me to a level of trust that I could live with it rather than what we're living with now.
Yeah,
with this kind of thing.
I want
happening.
A tight fist on the reign of government power. I really do.
I do too.
Because I recognize the government's voracious appetite for power, and it'll swallow up everything if you let it.
But
at the state level, at the mayor level, anyone that you give power to will eat more of it than he deserves.
Yeah. And I agree. Bill's comments were spot on. This needs to be a state issue because we've got to have it as close to us as possible. So. I think those are some good. I'm just telling you, background checks are fine. I would expect to have a background check to own a firearm, but
the people that's going to sift out is not going to be the target population that you're after.
It's just not.
At least not enough of them.
It'll stop some.
And I'm
but
all
there
for
are too
just
many
just
that
friction.
Can get through.
Just put friction. That's all these things are. We know that in a diseased society, we cannot stop acts of evil. We know that. But we can put friction, we can put obstacles between evil and innocence.
But here's another part of this discussion. We are likely to get gun laws, some new ones, okay? I think probably coming out of this, there's going to be something. And that something, even if we say that it's not going to solve the problem, it doesn't need to create a new problem.
Ones.
Right. So what I'm hoping is if we get, let's incentivize states for red flag. Let's do universal background checks. Let's do Let's have money available and a program to help school security. If we get those three things, okay, we can all kind of exhale and say, you know, we may not have solved the problem, but we didn't create a bunch of other problems that would be as serious as the one we're trying to solve.
And then
at
the same time, we need to talk to Philip before.
Philip,
go
ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, I agree with you guys. You guys are very, very interesting and speak to the point. I come from New Jersey, and there were a lot of mall shootings in New Jersey years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the talking was by the left that we can't have armed people in a mall. It frightens people. People come in there to shop with their little kids. To see a gun would be frightening
naive.
A child. I remember in Columbine, before the shooting, they wanted to have people at the school, and they said, oh, my goodness, you can't have people with guns. People coming to school every day would be frightened. So you see, we I think, understand that we have common sense responses to these issues, but the people on the other side, they see a gun as inherently evil.
Right,
and
that's a problem.
You know, that's the problem.
Yeah.
It's an inanimate object that's evil, and it's better to get kids killed than to frighten them by having armed people at school.
That's clear-eyed reasoning. Yeah.
Well, and the reason those kids are frightened is because their parents have not educated them about what a firearm is and who, when you see people like police officers carrying a firearm, that's a good thing. Kids are not going to be frightened if they're taught that.
That's right.
I'm going to tell you, when I was in Israel, when I went with AIPAC, I've never felt more secure.
Hmm.
I mean, I wondered about how I was going to feel over there because, you know, the amount of terrorist
region.
Attacks and all this kind of stuff. Man, there were Israeli soldiers everywhere.
Hmm.
with weapons. I mean, you couldn't go somewhere without seeing these, and they're highly trained. And when and the group that I rode with, we had four former Mossad officers, two in a car in front of us and two in a car behind us. And oh, and one on the bus. And I'm thinking to myself, what am I afraid? No, I feel like I'm fairly well protected here. I mean, that's the kind of thing that we need in this country.